I think it really taps into that sort of like, you know, treasure hunting desire that we all have, don't we? You know, that buried treasure, like, I'm going to be a pirate. You know, there's nothing more exciting about that sense of buried treasure. But it being such a significant find, and just really proving that, come on, this is a period in history where, you know, Britain had the ability to do wonderful workmanship.
Presented by Arcata, The Bigger Picture presents a special series of podcasts in partnership with London Art Week. A showcase of the best the art market has to offer, we take an inside look at the galleries participating and the stories behind the people that shape them. While Madeline Peridge's love for antiquity would start with bedtime stories, these ancient worlds, myths and legends would lead her down a road with the art world, her eventual destination. Leaving her academic studies for the world of work, Maddie's breaking into the art world was to prove difficult, with her lucky break coming almost a year and a half later. Once the head of the Antiquities Department at Bonhams and today the director of Kalos Gallery, Maddie shares how dog-eared determination and gut instinct have played a fundamental role. So like many of the guests in this series, you were actually a complete outsider to the art world. No family connections, no art dealing ties. Instead, it was experiences when you were young that seemed to gently nudge you down a road, I guess, with the art world as your eventual destination. And curiously, for you, it actually all begins with bedtime stories. Tell us about the tales your dad would read to you and the impact that this has had.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's when I think back, I had probably a greater knowledge of, you know, the stories of Odysseus and all of those monsters in the Odyssey than I did about the big bad wolf and, you know, the sort of the standard Grimm's fairy tales. My father was always very much into mythology and the ancient world. You know, he read a lot as a child himself, and I think was really transported by those stories and wanted to do the same for us. So, yeah, I mean, we had all the Theseus and the Amazons and books on Norse mythology, and they all have wonderful illustrations at the same time. And I think, you know, children's brains are so visual. They really absorb all of that. You know, it's the whole sensory experience. And I guess they kind of stuck with me. I mean, I think it probably really helped that my dad was he used to teach film studies. So we grew up watching Clash of the Titans and Jason and the Argonauts and, you know, again, I mean, these sort of great Technicolor Hollywood movies with, you know, moving monsters and all these crazy ladies with loads of arms. You know, as a kid, it's just transformative. And yeah, I guess it really stuck with me and yeah, left me with a sort of deep and abiding interest in the ancient world.
I mean, in the sense that your dad was, for want of a better expression, you know, helping close your eyes with visions of these ancient worlds by night. Your grandparents, they had a role in all this, that I believe they would routinely take you and your siblings to museums. Now, let's compare and contrast this imaginary world that your father's creating with the physical experiences of the museum. How did they bring these stories to life in some way, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of triplets, so my grandparents were always looking for a way to keep three small children entertained. So museums and art galleries were great. And you know, I think going to places like the Horniman Museum in South London, where I grew up, you see mummies in little sarcophagi and tiny scarabs and bright colours. And you know, the things that those people used every day, you know, going to museums and seeing little pairs of shoes and toys, those things, you know, small toys, really just, you know, they really appeal to children. Children can really go, oh, yeah, they were kids like me. You know, I think it brings the whole thing sort of down to your level and to your life. But at the same time, I mean, I think there was so much sort of magic as well to see from the archaeology and artworks in museums. I mean, yeah, sure, you know, mummies, obviously. What kid doesn't think that's amazing? But my sister and I were always completely obsessed with a statue of the goddess Kali at the Horniman Museum. She was a tongue out and all the arms, and you know, and when you've seen a many-armed goddess in a Sinbad film as well, and there it is, there's a statue of something in front of you, your parents are saying, yeah, you know, that's real, people used to worship that. I mean, that's pretty compelling stuff for a child.
At 15, let's just fast forward, you'd find yourself on a classics trip to Greece, obviously no longer a toddler by this point, on the cusp of young adulthood. At that point, where you're beginning to develop your own view of the world and seeing things like the Acropolis, Olympia up close, did you have any clue as to how you could turn this fascination into a career by this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was crucial that was my first real trip abroad, seeing another culture, you know, the art and the history and the ruins. You know, I think at that age you have your eyes wide open and you're looking to have different experiences. And yeah, Greece was just phenomenal for me. I'd been studying the classical world at school to a certain extent, but it really again brought it very much to life, but also in a slightly more kind of academic way that, you know, you were following, you know, the roots of all these sort of ancient Athenians and the tourists who'd also visited Rome and Athens and Olympia, and that's a wonderful kind of, you know, places you in a historical tradition that, you know, I think is kind of exciting when you're a teenager. But because I was studying it as well at the time, it really rooted it very much in a quite a serious thought about, can I do something like this, you know, for real? You know, there's people in museums, people work in museums, you know, people are archaeologists and they've dug all this stuff up. You know, can I do something like that? I mean, you know, that seemed pretty amazing as an option. And of course, I was very lucky in that, you know, that was something that I could do at school, not, you know, particularly nowadays, the study of classics is really very hard to do at school, particularly in state schools. You know, so I very much appreciate those opportunities.
How did you satiate that interest when you were not at school studying? What were you doing in your spare time? But presumably it's under your skin by that point.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Well, you know, I was one of those sort of sad nerds who would, you know, go to a secondhand bookshop and, you know, make a beeline for the ancient history section and the art and archaeology section. Again, I blame my dad. He loves a secondhand bookshop. Can't pass a secondhand bookshop by. So there we all are, you know, every time we go off to family holidays in Suffolk, it's, yay, bookshop, and off you all go. And my dad was most insistent that, you know, there was always money for books. So, you know, that's it. Even when I wasn't at school, it was reading, you know, the history of all these cool people. I was particularly, I think, in my teens, I was, you know, really into stories of historical women. And, you know, there was at that particular point as well, there was a lot of sort of academic study on women in Rome and Egypt, and some really cool stories about, you know, sort of female pharaohs like Hatshepsut, you know, that I could read and really start to engage with, again, in a slight sort of more academic way.
Were you ever out there getting your hands dirty as a youngster? I know that might sound like we're going in a different direction, but you think about films of late, like The Dig, about the Sutton Hoo.
Yeah.
Was that ever in your field of vision? Was that something you were doing as a youngster?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, we did all sat around to watch Time Team, obviously, on a Sunday. I know. It's hilarious, but it was epic. I did seriously sort of consider that, you know, even back as kids, you know, we did a lot of silly outdoors stuff. And, you know, we used to go fossiling on the beach. You know, sort of hammer and chisel, and here, Dad, I think I found one. No, it's not. But so, you know, there was a kind of, you know, I did have an engagement with that kind of, you know, with being out there and exploring it and doing a bit of sort of like wandering over fields. You know, we used to like doing things like that. You know, you go to Sutton Hoo and, you know, wander around, you know, all the grassy knolls and just sort of think, wow, you know, yeah, what's under here? But I did a bit of work experience in a museum, in the Museum of London, actually, which was, you know, kind of a really good, what's the word? I suppose it was, it gave me a really good sense of what a job in that sort of world would look like. And, you know, whilst I thoroughly enjoyed it, I did feel that, you know, lots and lots of tiny little inventory cards with little pieces of nail and tiny potsherds where you draw around the potsherd and, you know, make a little drawing of it so that, you know, it had all its record in case the object eventually got lost, I imagine. But, you know, that rapidly made it very clear that that probably wasn't going to be my forte. and I went on an archaeological dig when I went to university. That really crystallized. That was not going to be my future. Muddy puddles in Oxfordshire. Just no. And I have terrible luck. I never found a thing. So I felt that was probably a route that I was not going to be taking.
Yeah. I mean, you'd actually, you would go on to study classical archaeology and ancient history at Oxford. And it seems to be a significant moment around this point. It was here you'd met Professor Bert Smith. So how did his approach in teaching help you?
Yeah, I mean, it was really very, again, a bit of a stroke of luck that I was going to university at a time where Oxford University had created a brand new course called Classical Archaeology and Ancient History. You know, sort of before that, it's very much you could do ancient history, fine, or you can do sort of, you know, classics, where you have to do a very heavy component of the languages. And, you know, realistically, languages, really not my forte. Dead ones, live ones, just not. It's just not. It's just not the way my brain works, unfortunately. It's very sad.
Hand signals only.
Yes, exactly. Pictograms are fine. But yeah, so this, you know, I knew that classics as a degree wasn't going to work for me. And so I was looking at ancient history and archaeology courses elsewhere. But Cambridge did archaeology and anthropology, and that wasn't really for me. But so this new course where the idea was that you could have flexibility on studying the art and archaeology or the history, or you could do the language and literature as well. You know, it took away the sort of the rigidity of classics and opened up, I think, the study of, you know, classical archaeology to people who don't have a conventional sort of, you know, private school background where they've done Latin, they've had those opportunities. So, you know, it was really very exciting. It was a, you know, brand new course. There were only 14 of us. And because we were sort of the guinea pig year, I guess, they sort of very much figuring it out as we went along. You know, we had some small seminars and one-on-one tutorials, and we were a small group together. So I think, you know, for a lot of people, going to university is sort of, you know, kind of a means to an end to get you to a job. You know, you're doing something that kind of enjoy, but, you know, you're just going to go and join the civil service or go into law, and, you know, it's not necessarily a vocational subject. Whereas I think for a lot of us, if, you know, classical archaeology and ancient history was very much a vocational subject. We were all pretty passionate, and, you know, I think went in thinking, well, yeah, I think I might want to do this as a career. And it gave me, you know, some great tools to take on with me, you know, being able to look at the art and in detail and all different types of art. You know, a lot of the time you do a standard sort of, you know, Greek art course and you cover the vases and, you know, Praxiteles and Polycletus and, you know, the big sculptors. But, you know, there's very little opportunity to study glass or jewellery or, you know, all sorts of other things. And, you know, I think doing this particular course, you know, allowed me to open my eyes to that and to spend a lot of time at the Ashmolean, you know, seeing what was out there. You know, it's a great museum, and to have that literally attached to your university is, you know, was wonderful. So yeah, that was pretty crucial for me.
Let's fast forward to 2005, because by now you've left Oxford and the Courtauld too, with a master's in history of art. And it's now that, curiously, the hard part actually begins. Almost, yeah. It feels that way. No, let's return to this point. No family connections, no one on the inside. So you are basically tasked with breaking into the art world, you and you alone. Yeah. So how the hell did you get your foot in the door?
Well, I mean, you know, I was very lucky in that a family friend sort of had a friend who, you know, was connected in the art world. And I did manage to get a bit of work experience in that way, but 19th century paintings. But it was an auction house. And, you know, I was like, yeah, this is it. This is where I want to be. This is so cool. So, you know, once I sort of finished all my studies, it was like, right, okay, how am I going to do this? You know, this is particularly trying to get into antiquities as well. I mean, that's pretty niche. You know, in the end, it was just persistence, I suppose, sheer bloody mindedness. I really didn't let myself think that I couldn't do it and that I wouldn't manage and that somehow it wouldn't work out. You know, so I looked at all sorts of different fields, sort of sculpture, Asian art, Indian art. I joined a recruitment agency and took temping jobs in anything remotely adjacent to the art world. And actually that was key. That really was. I think the crucial point is just getting into work, because once you're in a job, you know, you can meet people, you can talk to other people, you have the time to you know, pick other people's brains, you know, try and pick up on their connections. So, you know, I did a really great reception job in a musical instruments dealers, and they were fantastic. They were such nice people. And, you know, because it's a small business, you spend a lot of time chatting and, you know, how did you get into this and what are you planning to do? And of course, because it was a sort of front of house job, there were lots of people trooping in and out. And there was a really nice guy who worked at Bonham's and in the musical instruments department. And he was like, oh, hey, yeah, I know the guys in the antiquities department. I'll introduce you. And I know. Art world adjacent. That's the way to go.
And that's 12 months. That 12 months has passed between... Yeah. Basically getting your foot in the door and that introduction coming through.
Yeah. I mean, more than really, more because than. You know, before that I'd done a bit of temping for an Indian art dealer. You know, I'd done other stuff, and you know, I mean, I think I was also very, very lucky in that, you know, I grew up in London, and you know, I think this is what's so very difficult now, is that how are you supposed to pick up work if most of the work available is either poorly paid or not paid? If, you know, you have to find somewhere to live in London. So, you know, it's still a very, very difficult thing to do to break into this. But yeah, thankfully, my internship eventually paid into a real life job.
I mean, I want to just return just for a moment to where you were describing your attitude of sheer bloody mindedness.
Yeah.
And what's quite interesting is your parents actually insisted you and your siblings to get a Saturday job.
Yeah.
I wonder if that had any bearing on that, the sense of determination. Because I think a lot of, understandably, to have dealt with so many knockbacks, of which you glaze over, but there were quite a few. Do you think that had a bearing on things? It was just...
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that understanding at a relatively early age that if you want something, you have to work for it. Not, well, I really like the idea of that. That sounds fun. You know, it's going to be easy because I've got money, connections, you know, blah, blah. I'll just make that happen. You know, it's to understand that everything that you want in life, you know, has to be worked for. is a pretty good thing to know in your teenage years. You don't take things for granted. You know, I mean, obviously, good Lord, we moaned like hell, and, you know, department store work is pretty deadly. but, you know, it does. It gives you work ethic. You just suck it up and get on with it and, you know, keep moving forward. But I guess my parents were very good in kind of instilling that in us, that if you want something, you will work for it and you will get it. There was never kind of a sense that I wouldn't get it, that, you know, I just had to work really, really hard. And, you know, so, yeah, whether it's just my sheer pig-headedness and stubborn belief in that, yes, I will get there in the end, crossed with a bit of luck and timing, I think, you know, do not underestimate the importance of timing and a bit of luck in all of this.
Mm-hmm. It's a great lesson, though, from your parents, though. Hard work.
Absolutely.
Great lesson. Let's return now to Bonhams. So I think we're around 2006 at this point, and that's come as a result of the introduction through the musical dealer's store. And you start as a trainee in the antiquities department.
Yeah.
Take us back to those first 2 weeks. You've got what you wanted now. What was it like?
Oh, my God. It was amazing. You know, never having worked in sort of a big company either, really, like that. I mean, you know, obviously Saturday jobs apart, you know, in a real sort of like living, breathing company where you're there every day and that's your job, that's your life. You know, I was half in the antiquities department, half tribal art as well. So that was quite fun because tribal art was something I had a passing sort of, you know, knowledge of, interest in. And, you know, sort of starting something like that totally from scratch was also really, really exciting. But I think the great thing is with an auction house is that, you know, you're there with lots of people your age, you know, people a bit older than you, all doing different specialist subjects. Every week there's, you know, a couple of different auctions on view. You know, you see so much. It was genuinely quite mind-blowing. And I think, you know, I guess the thing is that if I hadn't have enjoyed that sort of frenetic pace and, you know, the kind of the graft, and you have to really sort of be ready to turn your hand to all sorts of different things, you know, unpacking boxes and lugging stuff up and down stairs, you know, it's pretty hard work. But, you know, I think if you have that, it's that magic that every box that comes in, you know, every phone call from reception could be something mega and exciting, and, you know, but it was so overwhelming because I realized just how little I knew. I was, you know, I think you go into this sort of thing going, oh yeah, I've got a degree, I'm not going to be a complete numpty. And then you're like, oh yeah, I'm a complete numpty. I know nothing at all.
It's so interesting you should go that direction, because that's what's going through my mind as I'm listening. I'm wondering, was there anything that you picked up from your formal education that was immediately transferable, or was it just day one?
I think they're very much, you know, you do learn to look at objects through sort of your university education. You know, you do learn to actually interrogate an artwork. You know, to really look. And obviously it's great to have a huge amount of background knowledge about the culture, about the people. And, you know, that for me, I think, gave me a sort of a small level of comfort that, you know, there were things I was seeing that I was familiar with, and that was fine. But, you know, I'd never studied Egyptian art or Middle Eastern or Celtic, Anglo-Saxon. You know, it was just, there was so much other material from so many different cultures that I had no idea about. And that's before you even start with the fakes. So,
jeez.
Yeah, I mean, it's so massive. And, you know, you think, I'm never, ever going to be able to do what they do. but, you know, if you've got an eye and, you know, you understand that looking at something and, you know, absorbing it, and, you know, the next time you see a piece like that, you know, you've got that frame of reference. And, you know, if that piece is a fake, okay, how do I know it's a fake? What makes it a fake? What do I look for next time? It's all just building knowledge upon knowledge that, you know, eventually somewhere at some point you're like, oh, I know some things. Great. And don't feel quite so much of an idiot.
I'd like to just venture down this road a little bit, actually. And I'm going to preface this with running a business is difficult, number one. Mm. Running a business dealing in art is very, very difficult because you have to become a specialist. Running a business dealing in antiquities is really next level. Yeah. I think the antiquities dealer jumps through more hoops than any other business dealing in the art world. So could you shed some light on this for us? Because as to what makes dealing in antiquities so difficult and how significant it was that you were now exposed to the world of antiquities at Bonham's level.
Yeah.
And why that was just so overwhelming beyond belief. Help us understand what makes it so difficult.
I mean, I think when I started at Bonham's, you know, the key issues for putting together a successful sale and doing good business were sourcing the artworks, making sure the artworks were genuine, firstly, because there is a huge amount of fake antiquities out there. You know, this is a field that has been collected since, you know, the Renaissance. I mean, if you actually take it that far back, and as soon as there's a market for something, some enterprising soul will start faking it. So there's a lot of material out there which some was faked 200 years ago, some last week. And, you know, that is massive. Obviously authentication in any art field is crucial, but I think partly what's so complicated for ancient art is that there's a lack of certainty. Some things you can test, a lot of things you can't, or the tests aren't necessarily conclusive. A lot of it comes down to gut instinct, comes down to knowledge, comes down to working with other people who have also seen a lot of artworks. And I think learning all of that within an auction house structure was crucial. I think it takes a really, really long time to get to grips with that. And then, of course, you have to add, particularly nowadays, provenance history. That during the time I was at Bonham's, that became, you know, really a very, very major talking point. Again, you've got a market which went from, when you look at old auction catalogues from the 60s or 70s, I mean, they're quite small. There's not a lot there. Most of what's there is old collection. It's obviously come from old families. And then things exploded. It became big business, big market. And what followed with that was serious provenance problems with people doing some very dubious things. When something becomes valuable, unfortunately, criminal enterprise follows. And, you know, whilst I was at Bonham's, there was a lot of press attention on the sale of antiquities. And so the pressure on making sure that you don't mess up, that everything you're handling is as clean as it possibly can be, that's another layer of understanding and being very au fait with not just British law, but international law. It's a very complex field, and there are lots of different things that you have to think about. Probably create a really, really tedious flow chart on how not to make a mistake. But in the end, we all make mistakes. So, these things do happen. But because being at an auction house and the volume of material that you deal with, you have come up against every single possible permutation of disaster. And you learn. You're like, oh, yeah, should have seen that one coming. I'd be doing that again. It's, you know, it is a learning process. And, you know, I think doing that in a business environment as well, you know, you're trying to be a specialist, you know, you're trying to be, you know, a legal expert, and you're also trying to run a business. I mean, these are an awful lot of balls to keep in the air. But it's ideal training for, you know, going off and running a gallery, because, you know, you've basically done it in an auction house, and you know, it's a very similar kind of field.
I mean, relatively speaking, you actually would go on to rise through the ranks at Bonhams quite quickly and become the head of the department. Yeah. How did you handle such responsibility, that weight and burden of responsibility?
Yeah. I mean, it was absolutely terrifying. You know, I mean, it really, really absolutely was terrifying. I was extremely lucky, though, in that I had a great team who had really, really fantastic experience between them. So, you know, I was working with Siobhan Quinn, who's still at Bonhams, and she's been in the field for decades, has, you know, again, has seen everything you possibly can, you know. It's, and the same with Joanna Vanderland, who is a consultant, and I think sort of between the pair of them, you know, they sort of kept me on the straight and narrow and, you know, minimal utter boo-boos. You know, and I think that's the thing. You can't do this sort of job in isolation. You know, you need to understand that it's a bit of a team effort, because, you know, nobody is right 100% of the time. Sometimes you'll look at something and be like, oh, no, it's great. And if the other two are going, yeah, no, it's terrible. It's, you know, that's great. Everyone needs a sounding board.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was truly terrifying, and you're just learning from, you know, sort of panic to panic. But yeah,
the team is presumably almost acting like in making up, I guess, for, if it's not too crude an expression, one's own blind spot. So if you think about the managerial aspect, running a business, the dealing in volumes, that would be unrealistic to have that fall entirely on your shoulders and your shoulders alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I think that in some ways it was, you know, I think we were a great combination, because, you know, I was obviously, I was a lot younger, you know, was a lot more tech savvy, had lots more ideas about, you know, sort of the ways that we could do things. You know, I was able to travel a great deal, you know, not having children, and it meant that there were some great things that I could really drive forward in a business sense. But, you know, I always knew that when I was away, that everything would be ticking over, because, you know, Siobhan had it, you know, she'd done a gazillion sales herself. And I think it's also the emotional support. You know, both having run departments themselves, they really understood just how, you know, terrifying it was. And so, you know, and also I had you know, some really, really great sort of junior people, you know, join over a period of years. And, you know, I mean, I think that made a massive difference. You know, working with people who you love and you've built a great sort of, you know, just easy working relationship with, you know, just takes a lot of the stress out of it.
How did it feel to be on the other side of the interview desk? So you talk about the young people coming in.
I hate doing interviews.
It's your turn to send the elevator back down now.
Yeah. Oh, God. I really dislike interviews because I just don't think, you really get a good sense of somebody from, you know, sitting there having a chat. You know, it's, some people are great at talking the talk. Other people are just not. But it doesn't mean, you know, just because they're perhaps a little bit quieter or more reserved, that they're going to be heinous at their job. I mean, it's probably the reverse. You know, I've always believed in, with work, it's very much got to be a bit suck it and see. And that's why I think it's, you know, it's so important to have avenues into to businesses where people can do a bit of work experience. You know, you can get to know them, you know, make sure they don't do some absolutely ridiculous things that, you know, they're, because I think a big part of this job is it's a double whammy of being able to communicate really very effectively with people because it's such a client-facing environment. But also being kind of obsessively organized with like backroom paperwork. You know, there's, you have got to know what's going on at all times, you know, because the moment you take your eye off the ball, something terrible will happen. But until you give someone a chance to show you what they can do, and I mean, how is anyone going to really understand what this job entails until they actually get stuck into it? You know? So, yeah, I'm a great believer in work experience, or, you know, that's why I think sort of salary assistance, it's really important to have lots of opportunities for people, just because they need to know if they really want to go into it. You know, a lot of people, you know, sort of, I think, go into an auction house and think it's going to be one thing, and it's absolutely entirely another thing. And the same with the art world. I think there's a sort of idea that it's all, you know, champagne parties and, you know, enjoying yourself at art fairs. And sure, that's a big part of it. But, you know, the other part is clambering over mouldy crates and crowbarring things off of walls. And, you know, I mean, some of the things that you've ended up doing in this job. It's like, really? Really? I definitely. This was, like, not my pay grade anymore. But, you know... So yeah, I think you need to know what you're getting into.
Yeah, wise words. So it's 2009, let's fast forward. Staffordshire metal detectorist Terry Herbert goes on to find the largest Anglo-Saxon gold in Britain.
Yeah.
And you are asked to participate in its valuation. So take us back to that moment. What kind of things can you learn from buried treasure that you can't in books and catalogues, or at that point, by that point, handling works at auction?
Yeah. I mean, I think the crucial thing with the Staffordshire Award was that, you know, it really brought home to the British public that, you know, the Dark Ages was definitely not dark. You know, I think on the continent there is, you know, there's always been a much greater understanding of that period in history. Kings and the rulers and the quality of the metalwork and jewellery, because, you know, you've got great artworks in major museums, and I think there's a sort of a greater engagement with that period in history, whereas we, you know, it's really not a period that anyone studies here, and you know, and I think Sutton Hoo also made a huge difference, and I think, you know, the Staffordshire Hall, though, it's that sort of like once in a generation treasure finding sort of just excitement that grips all sorts of different people from all sorts of backgrounds that, oh my goodness, look at this gold and the garnets and the workmanship. And that's just some guy with a metal detector. I can do that. I could totally do that. You know, I think it really taps into that sort of like, you know, treasure hunting desire that we all have, don't we? You know, that buried treasure, like, I'm going to be a pirate. You know, there's nothing more exciting about that sense of buried treasure. But it being such a significant find, and just really proving that, come on, this is a period in history where, you know, Britain had the ability to do wonderful workmanship. And, you know, but it also to be so highly valued, you know, that makes a pretty big statement again about, you know, the quality of the work, and seeing it all laid out there in the British Museum was just boggling. I mean, it's still all covered in mud. This was pre-conservation. You know, you couldn't really, with a lot of the pieces, like, absolutely be sure of what was going on underneath. You'd sort of go, well, that looks like it's all garnet inlaid. I can't really tell if it goes all the way along. I'm going to assume it probably does. You know, even when it was there, it still had that mystery, that, you know, what it could be, this sense of what it might look like. once it had been conserved. And of course, you know, once all the work had been done and when it was finally exhibited, it just, I mean, again, I was like, whoa. it really was just a phenomenal experience, just seeing that sort of material up close. You know, we don't handle a lot of it in the art world. It doesn't come up very often. Anglo-Saxon and Merovingian migration period pieces, particularly of that quality. So, you know, seeing that hoard having come last seen, you know, going into the ground by whichever poor soul abandoned it, was pretty phenomenal.
Amazing. You were with Bonhams for 10 years, leaving in 2016, and you would go on to manage Kalos Gallery, founded by one of the most important private collectors of ancient art. What can you tell us about the gallery's founder and how did your paths cross exactly?
Sure. Baron Lorn Thyssen-Bornemisza founded Kalos sort of very much with the idea of supporting the study of ancient art and the understanding that private collecting, is legal, is possible, and trying to sort of create a forum where you can have, you know, these sort of traditionally quite, you know, nowadays quite sort of polarized viewpoints, you know, in a place together. Also, you know, we did a lot of education events, lots of school children. Baron Thyssen supports Classics for All, which is a wonderful charity who fund teachers in classics in state schools all over the country. And, you know, I think it's the idea behind it is absolutely wonderful. We've met some fantastic people and given, you know, countless school children the chance to handle, you know, gold coins at the same time as they're learning Latin. I mean, you know, that's, again, for me, that would have been mind-blowing as a school kid. So, you know, I think the idea behind it, really exciting. And I'd come across Baron Thyssen sort of in the past, and the existing Kalos team before I joined Kalos. And we were sort of put in touch through sort of mutual friends and colleagues. That I might be interested in leaving Bonhams and, you know, for this sort of opportunity. I'd not really thought about leaving Bonhams. It was kind of, they're going to carry me out in a body bag type thing. once you get past 7 years, that's it. Yeah, they're institutionalized. Obviously Kalos was just genuinely a unique opportunity and one I definitely wasn't going to turn down.
I think this is significant because 2 years later, you'd be invited to participate in TEFAF, which marks an important moment, not only in your career, but that of the gallery too.
Yeah.
Could you talk about how the gallery was originally founded to deal in Greek art and how you and your team, Beth and Haley, have helped shape and reframe how ancient art is presented?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So when I started at Kalos, talking with Beth and Haley, we felt very strongly that that whilst Greek art was really the basis on which the gallery was founded, that we wanted to broaden that out. I think that Greek art has such an influence on the rest of antiquity, and Greek art in itself was also heavily influenced by the Middle East and art of Egypt. You know, this is ancient world full of travel and influences and, you know, people picking up ideas from other people, and invasions and, you know, conquering and, you know, then the, it's, it seemed that there was so much more that we could enjoy and we could show. So for TEFAF, that was a really important chance for us to show what the new Kalos was about. TEFAF is such a mecca for the art world, and, you know, so many people knew of Kalos, you know, had perhaps have visited, or they had an idea of what we were and who we were and what we were doing. And we very much wanted to show, well, okay, you might have heard this or you might have heard that, but this is who we are. You know, come see us, you know, come meet us, see what we do. And, you know, it was, I think TEFAP is great fun as well, because all the sections are in together. So you're surrounded with all the other ancient art dealers, who obviously I've known for, you know, a huge part of my life. And, you know, it's a very sort of warm community, and we're quite a small market with all the same collectors. And it's, you know, it was so much fun to be there for the first time. You know, we'd all been there looking around, you know, in the past we'd attended just as visitors, but to be an exhibitor for the first time, you know, I think it was really thrilling and a great chance for us to, you know, to start working with other dealers, to build those connections, and, you know, and to really, yeah, sort of create a future for the gallery, I suppose.
Mm. One last question. If you could go back and give your younger self advice at the start of your journey, what would it be?
Trust your gut. Every single mistake I have ever made is because I didn't listen to myself. And there was nothing more frustrating than looking back and going, I so knew that was going to happen. So knew that was going to happen. But I mean, of course, yeah, you do learn from that. But, you know, I think the important thing is have faith in yourself and your knowledge and your experience. You know, your clients are trusting you. And I think you have to, in the same way, trust yourself to give them the best, you know, sort of experience, to make sure that they can buy in confidence, that they can sell in confidence. You know, I think, yeah, you understand you're going to make mistakes. I mean, you just will. You know, even the dealers, the most well-established dealers who've been in the business for, you know, 40 years, you know, they will still make mistakes. Everybody does. But it's how you handle it, what you learn from it, you know, how you move forward, really. I think also for me as well is, whilst, yeah, sure, trust yourself, but don't discount other people's advice. You know, it is a specialized market that we're all working in. You know, collaborate. Talk to other people. I mean, that's the thing I've had the most benefit from, is, you know, talking to dealers. I mean, sometimes when I put together auctions at Bonhams, and, you know, and one of the dealers would come up and say, look, I really don't think that's right, or, you know, and it's so easy in sort of the heat of embarrassment and, oh, I've made a mess of something, to just want to ignore it, to, you know, go, they've obviously got an agenda, I'm not listening. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're doing you a solid. They're just giving you the benefit of their wisdom. You should trust it, or at least, you know, explore it, you know, think again, you know, keep asking yourself, you know, is this right? Would I buy this? Am I confident with everything I've done? And yeah, I mean, I think we all want to work together and make this market the most sort of robust, exciting, but ultimately sort of trustworthy that it can be, because we want our clients to continue to collect and to enjoy themselves. We want a healthy, thriving market. So, you know, I think it's, yeah, lots of teamwork. It's really important. So I'm very lucky to work in an industry with lots of wonderful people who are all just as sort of nerdy and passionate as I am. So, yeah, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening. You can follow and subscribe to The Bigger Picture wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about this episode or to reach out to us directly, please visit rcarter.com. Thank you.